Hello and welcome to the Science Magazine podcast for September 4th, 2009. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, a special podcast on cooperation. First up, the origin of cooperation. Then, dog sensitivity to human communication. And lastly, promoting public cooperation through rewards rather than punishments. All this plus a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about how pigeons whistle with their wings, from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
So this essay is all about cooperation and the origins of cooperation.
In our year-long series on evolution, Science's Elizabeth Panisi has our latest installment, her essay on the origin of cooperation.
It deals with why one individual would be willing to do something for another individual, even though that means some self-sacrifice on its part. Evolutionarily speaking, cooperation makes no sense, because you're supposed to be looking out for yourself. But yet there's cooperation everywhere. There's cooperation in people, in bees, in microbes, in yeast. And this essay takes a look at what are the factors that influence whether one individual will cooperate with another. What are the factors that influence whether one individual will cheat on another?
When does the origin of cooperation begin?
That's a very hard question, because depending on how you look at it, you can say that you see cooperation at the level when single-cell organisms became multicellular organisms. With single-cell organisms that sort of somehow managed to stick together, work together, specialize, do different things, that's all cooperation. So, for example, right now, there's a lot of interest in looking at cooperation in microbes. And it's very common that you get one type of bacteria joining forces with another type of bacteria, basically by virtue of just being together. They form aggregations, and in these aggregations, one bacteria might produce a substance that the other bacteria uses. These are called biofilms, and that's a form of cooperation too.
So not even multicellular organisms necessarily, just bacteria.
Just bacteria.
What was Darwin's understanding of cooperation?
Darwin was perplexed by cooperation. There are several places in The Origin of Species where he talks about how he worried about the fact that when you see, say, cooperation between two species, how could that be? How could that follow his idea of natural selection? And he also worried about how it is that you would get a worker bee to sacrifice its life for its hive. But he also had a rudimentary understanding of how that might be possible and how that might work. For example, with respect to the bees, he figured that basically bees are just one large family, and so you were sacrificing for the family. So he sort of was ahead of his time in sort of understanding how cooperation could exist.
Have scientists identified genes then for cooperation?
In some sense, yes. There is a type of gene called a green beard gene. And this was a gene that existed in theory only for a long time. And the idea is you could have two individuals that possess this gene. There would be something about the gene that would make the two individuals realize that they shared this gene, and therefore they would cooperate and perpetuate the proliferation of that particular gene. So in other words, it was a way for cooperation leading to the perpetuation of a particular gene. So for example, they have discovered in slime molds an example of what they call this green beard gene. Now, slime molds are single-cell amoeba that when they live in the soil, but when conditions get tough, a bunch of them will find each other, form a sort of multicellular slug that crawls to the surface and then forms a fruiting body that releases spores that will get to sort of be able to go to places that have more food. So when you have the formation of these fruiting bodies, not everybody gets to reproduce. Some of the amoeba become part of the stalk, and only a few of the amoeba become part of the fruiting body, which means they produce spores and they get to reproduce. So what happens is you have a situation where you might have cheaters because, for example, certain amoeba might not let themselves become part of the stalk and instead just become part of the fruiting body, in a sense cheating, so they only get to reproduce. They don't sacrifice themselves in any way. So one way to make sure that doesn't happen is for there to be one of these green beard genes. And what happens is the green beard gene in amoeba, it's a cell surface protein that helps the amoeba stick to another amoeba that has the same cell surface protein. So as these amoeba are coming together to form the slug, the ones with these proteins stick together and aggregate together, so they all the amoeba that form the fruiting body all carry this protein, and you're guaranteed that this protein is going to be perpetuated, that the gene for this protein is going to be perpetuated.
So this is a real instance of what had been before, just a theoretical green beard gene.
Correct.
Now, both with cooperation and with cheating, which takes advantage of cooperation, what about cooperation within a species where individuals are unrelated? Does that happen in any other species besides people?
It does happen with other species, but people take it to the extreme. I mean, among people, you will have strangers helping strangers who they will never see ever again. And that goes against all ideas about why cooperation persists. I mean, if you're going to have cooperation between unrelated people, you do a favor for someone because you expect that one day they'll do a favor for you. But with people, people will do favors for someone they might never meet again.
Any consensus on why that happens or how that developed?
Well, there's several ideas around. One idea, which has been put forth by a man named Samuel Bowles from Santa Fe Institute, is that way back in human history, when we were small hunter and gatherer tribes, there was a lot of violence between tribes, so that it was very important that within the tribe, you would really work together, and those that worked together would win out over tribes that didn't work as closely together. And within a tribe, you weren't necessarily related to everybody. So what developed was this type of caring and cooperation between non-relatives that's sort of been perpetuated ever since. But there's always the question of what keeps the people within the individuals within the tribe cooperating. And there's been a lot of discussion about that. One idea is that you cooperate with people you don't necessarily know because you want to have a good reputation for cooperating. Because if you have a good reputation for cooperating, you're more likely to get help when you need it than if you don't have a good reputation for cooperating. Other aspects that researchers have looked into is sort of what is the role of punishment and also of reward in keeping cooperation going. There are some studies that indicate punishment and then subsequently the threat of punishment is enough to keep cooperation going strong. There are other studies that show that reward works much better as a tool for perpetuating cooperation.
So when there's not that threat of war with another tribe, what are rewards and punishments that individuals might dole out to help people learn cooperation in peacetime?
I don't know exactly what the rewards are in a real lifetime situation in a tribe. I mean, it could be food reward, it could be status symbols, it could be any number of things. What I do know is when they actually try and test human behavior in a laboratory situation, the type of rewards tend to be money, and the type of punishment can be the sort of withholding of money. So those experiments that used money and found the role for punishment, there are other experiments that found that punishment in the long run wasn't a good strategy and instead that reward was a good strategy. And I think this reflects how complicated sort of cooperation is and how difficult it is to really study it. the best we can do is make up games that approximate cooperative situations and try and extrapolate from that why we do what we do. But it's really hard to explain because cooperation evolved over the evolutionary time scale over many thousands or hundreds of thousands of years. And the most we can do in the lab is look at it in real time.
Elizabeth Panisi, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Science's Elizabeth Panisi writes on the origin of cooperation in this week's issue. You can find the whole series of Origin essays and a companion blog celebrating the year of Darwin at www.sciencemag.org/Darwin. Previous research has shown that 10-month-old children will make what's called a perseverative search error, meaning they'll continue to search for a toy in the same place that they've repeatedly retrieved the toy from before, even when they watch someone put the toy somewhere else. Now, in a paper in this week's Science, Josef Topal and colleagues showed that dogs will make the same error too, but for a different reason. The researchers report that the dog's response is primarily driven by a motivation to satisfy what scientists call ostensibly cued human imperatives, or following human orders, even when the dog may know that the human's actions don't lead to the right goal. Wolves, however, do not show the same dog or human-like errors, and that suggests that dogs' sensitivity to human communication comes from convergent social evolution over the tens of thousands of years that people and dogs have lived together. I spoke with Topal from his office at the Hungarian Academy of Sciences in Budapest.
So here we conducted three experiments. In the first one, we found that dogs are also prone to misinterpret the communicative cues of the experimenter. The results of the second experiment showed that wolves are not. And in the third experiment, we point to that the exact nature of that misinterpretation differs from humans and dogs. That is, there are probably different underlying cognitive processing in these species when committing the perseverative search error.
What communication from humans did the wolves essentially ignore?
In our task, the human experimenter addressed the subject and used eye contact with the subject. And this addressing and making eye contact can be interpreted as a kind of communicative intent, the expression, the manifestation of communicative intent on the part of the human experimenter. This is the case for a human infant, and we mean that dogs are also sensitive to these kind of communicative signals, but wolves not.
So the wolves didn't pay attention to humans the way the dogs or babies did?
Yes, exactly.
Had these wolves been raised in the same way that dogs are?
No, not exactly. These dogs were pet dogs, family dogs, but wolves were extensively socialized and hand-reared wolves. They were in 24 hours human contact during their first 4 months of their life, and then they returned to the wolf park, and now they are living in small packs, and they are in regular contact with different human beings, and they often participate in shooting, film, and so on. So they are tamed animals and easy to handle them. But of course, the socialization regimen was different because a family dog, a dog puppy, is not in 24 hours human contact during their first months of their life.
And this experiment was conducted within those first 4 months of the wolves' lives?
This experiment was conducted with adult animals, with adult pet dogs and adult hand-reared wolves.
So is it possible that these differences between dogs and wolves and their sensitivity to human communication could be a function of the different training regimens?
Yes, exactly. It's hard to separate the effect of socialization, the differences in their socialization and differences in their genetic background or inborn skills. But, okay, it's a complex problem. And it's always a complex problem, not only for dogs and wolves, for comparative studies using dogs and wolves, but also it's always a problem for ape studies.
Sure.
Because some chimps were hand-reared in labs and others captured and so on and so on.
Let's turn then to the differences between dogs and children. Did the dogs and children respond with the same sensitivity to human communication in this study?
Okay, in this study, we only measured the choice behavior of the subject, which location is approached first. So it is not a study in which we could analyze how they react. But we think that dogs didn't generalize between the different contexts when we changed the experimenter. So we think that the behavior similarity between human infants and dogs in this task is only a surface similarity. And the social communicative cues is not identical for dogs and for human infants. I think that in dogs, the responsiveness to human communication stems from their motivation to satisfy ostensibly cued human imperatives in the here and now, and even when the human action demonstration conveys an inefficient or a mistaken solution to the task. And this was not the case for human infants, because human infants showed special sensitivity and preference for these ostensible communicative signals, and they interpret the situation as a learning situation.
Okay, so you and your team showed children generalized communication, or what they learn from person to person.
Children generalize, yes, exactly.
But dogs don't.
Dogs don't generalize. When we change the person, they didn't commit perceptive error. So they didn't generalize. Dogs only tried to satisfy a human imperative.
Is it possible that lack of generalization has been selected for in dogs too, in that people wouldn't want their dogs to just take orders from anybody?
Selected for certain breeds of dogs or for dogs in general?
Right, that people would select for this in certain breeds or in all dogs.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I don't know the exact answer to this question. Okay, it's possible, but...
Is that something that your team might be investigating in further studies?
Maybe. It's one of the possibilities for taking another step in order to deepen our understanding the dog's social cognition, or how a dog perceives human communication. In the next step, it would be interesting to see a detailed analysis of the human-dog communicative interaction. What is the role of the sequence of the manifestation of the different human communicative cues? For example, in human communication, the eye contact is an introductory signal, and it is often followed by addressing, verbal addressing, and then a referential cue, for example, pointing or head turning to a certain direction, and so on and so on. And we would like to see whether for a dog, the sequence of these human communicative cues is important or not important. Okay, one possibility is that the dog is simply sensitive to eye contact, and when a human make eye contact with the dog will be alert or attentive to the human. Or another possibility is that the sequence is important also for the dog, like for human infant, because in a communicative interaction, the eye contact at the end of the communicative sequence has a different meaning than the eye contact as an introductory signal. So it would be a very interesting and important question, the role of the sequence of human cues, so the effect of the sequence.
Jozef Topal, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Robert Frederick.
Jozef Topal of the Hungarian Academy of Sciences is lead author of a paper on the differential sensitivity to human communication in dogs, wolves, and human infants. How much would you be willing to pay to punish someone who was freeloading from the common pool of resources? What if it cost you the same amount to reward someone else who's contributing his or her fair share? What's best for me if I want to maximize my share of the common pool, contributing or not contributing, punishing freeloaders or rewarding contributors, knowing that others can punish or reward me too? These are the kinds of questions participants face in playing public goods games, the classic way to study problems of cooperation and collective action. Now, in a paper in this week's Science, David Rand and colleagues report their results from such a game, but one played with a twist. Participants get to know one another's reputation as freeloader or contributor, punisher or rewarder. In such a game, the team reports, it is in your own best interest and the best interest of the group if everyone rewards people who do their part for the common good and not punish, but simply not reward those who don't. The research suggests that cooperation in such settings, where reputation is at play, is best supported by positive or rewarding interactions with others. I spoke with Rand from his office at Harvard University.
In this study, we looked at the relative effectiveness of reward and punishment for motivating individuals to contribute to the group and to do things that are costly for themselves but beneficial to everyone in the group that they're involved in. And what we found is that when you give groups the option to either reward or punish, rewarding is much more effective than punishing for encouraging people to contribute to the group in repeated settings, and groups that use reward got significantly higher payoffs than groups that punished. And I should say that this is all in the context of behavioral economics laboratory experiments. So people were interacting in groups for money, where the amount of money that they got paid for participating depended on their actions in the game. So in this study, punishing means I pay a cost for you to incur a cost. And rewarding is I pay a cost for you to get a benefit. So in punishing, we both lose out. Whereas in rewarding, on average, if I reward you and you reward me, then we're both better off than if neither of us had done anything.
If you scratch my back, I scratch yours is better for everybody.
Exactly. And everybody's back is nice and scratched.
Is it this reward component that distinguishes your team study from previous studies on public cooperation?
Yes. So the vast majority of the experiments on what can encourage people to contribute to the public good, as it's called, focused on the role of punishment and showing that people were willing to incur costs to punish people that were free riding and not contributing, and that this in turn made people willing to contribute. And so in our paper, we felt that rewards had been severely neglected, and also that a lot of previous experiments had been set up in such a way that was not really realistic and that hurt the ability of rewards. So in our study, we looked at repeated interactions where the same groups interacted again and again in a way that everyone knew who was playing the game and who had done what. And we found that in that setting, rewards worked just as well or better than punishments.
Meaning that lack of reward would not possibly be seen as a punishment itself?
Right. So I think that's a really good point. In our paper, what we're comparing is a situation where you reward people when they contribute and you deny reward when they don't is one sort of treatment. And then another treatment is you do nothing when people contribute or you pay to punish them when they don't contribute. So we are using denial of reward as a form of punishment, but it's not costly to punish the other person. And so if you contribute, then I'll be willing to pay to help you. But if you don't contribute, then I'm just going to leave you alone. As opposed to if you don't contribute, then I'm going to pay to really hurt you.
Now, you said that your study was perhaps more realistic than previous studies on public cooperation. Why does repeated interaction make it more realistic?
Okay, so maybe as opposed to more realistic, what I should say is it reflects a wide range of situations which the previous settings don't. So there are certainly a lot of situations in life that are non-repeated settings, like if you're, you know, waiting in line at the airport or if you're driving in traffic, you have these sort of one-off kind of interactions with people. But we think that most of your really important interactions, the one that really matter for your life, are repeated interactions with your friends, family, coworkers. And those are the sort of interactions that are the real substance of your life.
So in this game, there's full transparency, a restricted population size, and those who do not behave toward the common good can't simply move off and swindle someone else, if you will.
Right.
What kind of situations might lend themselves toward reward for cooperation rather than punishment or threat of punishment? These everyday interactions that make up most of our lives, you said.
Right. So I think all of these interactions with friends, family members, and coworkers, these people that you see regularly again and again, in those sort of settings where there is reputational effects and there is repetition, our study suggests that you would do well to be nice to the people that are helpful to you and or to be nice to the people that you see contributing to the group. And then if you see people sort of not doing their part as opposed to sort of going out of your way to really, you know, hurt them and punish them for it, you should just stop helping them and use sort of denial of reward as an incentive for them to do their part.
Is there any cultural bias here? Were there any instances of antisocial punishment or punishing someone for being too giving and group interested?
So the cultural component of this is extremely interesting. In our study, we only used American college students, which in a paper in Science in, I guess, last year from Simon Gechter's group, they looked at these punishment games across societies and found in places like the U.S. and the U.K., almost all of the punishment was directed at free riders that weren't contributing, whereas in some other countries, it was the opposite, that lots of punishment was being directed towards the contributors. And so we saw very little of that in our study, but we think that that's all the more reason that rewards may be better than punishments, which is in cultures other than our own, punishment can be really destructive when it's used, you know, when the low contributors punish the cooperators. But with rewards, there's no such danger of that because, you know, if you have people rewarding each other when they shouldn't, that's, you know, good, really, as opposed to being costly for everyone involved.
Any political or cultural messages then in this study beyond that of just those whom you interact with?
That's another really interesting question. With all of these games in the lab, all these public goods games with punishment or reward and these kind of things, for the most part, they're set up in a symmetric way that this is about peer punishment or peer reward as opposed to state punishment or state reward. And in those kind of situations where you have a strong state compared to a weak individual and also a state that makes pre-commitments to how it's going to act by publishing the laws. You know, the sort of state says, if you do this, you will be punished. If you do this, you will be rewarded. Those are sort of major differences from the way that these experiments are set up. And so it's unclear to what extent these results generalize to politics. We are fundamentally evolutionary biologists, and so we do a lot of thinking about sort of early human evolution in small groups where, you know, you're sort of looking at the emergence of cooperation. And so we feel like those are the settings that these are. And, you know, so in those settings, people have evolved certain preferences for how to respond to different motivations. And then when they come into the lab in the modern day, we use the lab as a way to sort of get a snapshot of those preferences. But the question of how these generalize to larger institutions is an open question that we're pursuing in current research.
The idea then that these social behaviors, this group cooperation, might not be a learned behavior, but perhaps an evolutionarily selected one?
Right. I mean, this is a fundamental idea in a lot of evolutionary biology, that this ability to cooperate and work together brings great benefits to societies that have it and to individuals that successfully engage in cooperation. And so this is the question of how this behavior could have evolved, given that evolution is very selfish and, you know, sort of favors those who do what's in their own interest. It raises a great question of how this seemingly altruistic and cooperative behaviors could emerge.
David Rand, thank you very much.
All right, thanks a lot.
David Rand of Harvard University is lead author of a paper on how positive interactions promote public cooperation. Finally today, David Grimm, editor of Science's online daily news site, Science Now, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about how pigeons whistle with their wings. Something about how they flap them differently, or something about the wing itself, Dave?
Well, Rob, it turns out that some birds have special feathers in their wings that make these wings make distinctive sounds when the birds take off. So, for example, here's the sound a pigeon makes when it takes off normally.
And that's not the bird vocalizing anything.
No, actually, what you're hearing there, Rob, is the sound of feathers fluttering and vibrating against the air as the bird takes off, and that's making these distinctive sounds. So listen to the sound again. Now listen to this sound. And what you'll notice, what's different about that second sound is it sounds almost more urgent. It's faster, and it just sounds different from that first sound. And what's different about that second sound is that's the sound pigeons make when they take off when they're startled. So this is not a normal, hey, I'm going to go fly and go somewhere. This is, you know, I just saw something that really scared me and I'm taking off.
So it's a signal then to other pigeons?
Well, that was the question with the study. Does this sound mean anything to other pigeons? You know, when we usually think about bird alarm calls, we think about birds making some sort of vocalization that would warn their companions, hey, there's a predator coming, or hey, there's a guy that's going to come try to shoot us or something. But the question in this study is, can birds also make these warning calls with other parts of their body? And it turns out that's what the function of the sound is. At least that's what researchers say they found. What they did was they recorded a lot of these sounds. So they recorded these normal takeoffs from pigeons, and also they startled pigeons by throwing a glider near them that resembled an accipiter hawk, which is one of their predators. And then they played back these sounds to a flock of pigeons. And what they found was that when they just played this normal takeoff sound, the pigeons didn't do anything. They just sort of went about their daily business. But when they played this alarm takeoff sound, all of a sudden these pigeons started scattering. A lot of the birds took off, or they were looking around like they were really startled.
And that's not because the wings are moving faster.
Right. When birds are startled, they take off faster, but they also take off at a different angle. And the researchers think this is what contributes to this unique sound. And these birds also have a special feather, this very narrow outer feather on their wing that also seems to contribute to the sound, although the researchers aren't exactly sure how.
And this is pretty widespread, right?
Well, that's the thought. A lot of birds seem to have this modified feather, so it's possible that a lot of different types of birds also make this warning call when they take off because they're startled.
Okay. So what other stories have you got with you this week?
Well, Rob, speaking of unusual adaptations on animals, let's talk about another adaptation on an ancient animal called a glyptodont. And this is this very bizarre creature. You can see a picture of it on the site. But basically, it looks like almost like a giant turtle. Some of these animals were as large as small cars, with these very long tails and these long heads that poked out. A very unusual creature.
Ancient creature, so it's not around anymore.
Right. These creatures died out about 10,000 years ago, and they lived as long as 20 million years ago. And one of the really unusual things about this creature is its long tail. And researchers have wondered for a while, exactly what did it use this tail for? Some have speculated that they used it for defense against predators. Others have speculated that they used these tails like moose use their antlers. Maybe males battled each other by whacking their tails against each other.
So two hypotheses, defense or competition. How do you test that in an animal that's dead?
Well, the researchers had this really interesting hypothesis, and it all goes back to baseball. As you know, there's something called a sweet spot on a baseball bat, where if you hit the ball on this particular part of the bat, the vibrations cancel each other out, so you really don't feel a lot of that impact. And the researchers wondered, you know, these glyptodonts have these large tails that they're potentially using to thwack other creatures. Do these tails also have a sweet spot, and might that clue them in to what the tails were being used for in the first place? So they went back and they looked at a bunch of different glyptodonts, and these things really ranged in size, and their tail sizes range from about 34 to 105 centimeters. And the researchers found that these tails did indeed have a sweet spot. And what was even more interesting was in the larger tails, precisely where the sweet spot was, the creatures also seemed to have had a horny spike. And this seemed to be good evidence that the large glyptodonts, at least, were using their tails for competition. Because if males are competing with each other, they don't necessarily have to be fast. You know, sort of think about two mooses sort of staring each other down and fighting over a female. It's sort of a slow, labored competition. But with these smaller glyptodonts, what the researchers saw was that these spikes tended not to be associated with the sweet spot, which suggests that with the larger glyptodonts, there was this really intense selection, that they really needed this spike at the sweet spot, because if they didn't have that, they weren't going to, you know, get the girl for all intents and purposes. But with the smaller glyptodonts, the selection was much more random, because these guys were probably thwacking their tails around a lot more randomly as a defense against small predators. So it turns out that both hypotheses were probably right. The glyptodonts used their tails for defense and also for competition, just depending on the size of the glyptodont.
Okay. So last story this week. What's this last one about?
Well, Rob, whether these glyptodonts were using their sweet spots on their tails or not, you and I probably wouldn't have wanted to stand so close to them. And it turns out we don't really want to stand so close to each other either.
Am I too close?
You're not too close right now, but if you were to get a few steps closer to me, I would start to get uncomfortable. And that's because I have a sense of personal space, as do you. You know, when we're talking to people, or, you know, when we're having a conversation with people, or just interacting with people, we tend to keep some distance.
About an arm's length.
About an arm's length. That sounds good. But researchers don't know what accounts for the sense of personal space. They think it has something to do with a region of our brain called the amygdala. And this is this almond-shaped region deep in the brain that's been shown to be responsible for our sense of fear. It helps us, say, recognize threats. But this is really hard to test in humans, or at least it was until researchers came across this really interesting case about 15 years ago of a 42-year-old woman who had this rare genetic disorder that basically destroyed her amygdala. And all of a sudden, researchers said, hey, now we can test all these hypotheses we had about what the amygdala does in humans. And the first hypotheses they tested were these fear hypotheses. They showed that the woman couldn't spot fear in other people's faces. So they would show her pictures of people that looked like they were afraid, and she just thought they were looking normal. She also tended to rate people as more trustworthy than the average person would. But with this new study, they wanted to test, okay, what's the amygdala's role in our sense of personal space? And what really gave them a clue that the amygdala was important for personal space in humans was that this woman, who has this nickname SM because they never revealed the names of people in these studies, she had this unusual behavior where when even if she was meeting somebody for the first time, she would stand very close to them and she would touch their arm and sometimes even poke their stomach during conversation. So she really didn't seem to have any sense of personal space. But the researchers wanted to be more rigorous about testing this sense of personal space. So what they did was they compared this woman to 20 healthy subjects who had normal amygdalas. And the researchers would say, put one of these subjects in a part of the room, and the researcher would start walking towards the person. They would say, okay, tell me when you start to get uncomfortable. When I'm getting too close, tell me to stop. And what they found is that SM let the researchers get a lot closer to her, even nose to nose, before she felt uncomfortable, where the other subjects wanted the researchers to stay at least an arm's length away. And to further test the role of the amygdala, the researchers had all the subjects sit in an fMRI scan, or an fMRI is basically just a machine that measures brain activity. And what the researchers found as they walked closer to the subjects while they were in the scanner, their amygdalas lit up brighter on fMRI, which indicated there was a lot more activity in the amygdala, which really further supports this idea that the amygdala is responsible for our sense of personal space. The researchers say it's almost like the amygdala functions as a set of brakes during our social interactions. It sort of tells us, hey, when to stop when things are starting to get uncomfortable, as when maybe somebody gets a little too close to you during a conversation.
So there's actually a moderating effect on regular social interaction, not just a pure fear response that the amygdala is typically associated with.
Right. It really seems to play an important role in how we behave with each other every day. And as they could see with SM, she wasn't really behaving like other people behave during normal conversation. And just as an aside, if you're interested in learning more about the amygdala, we actually have another story up this week about a woman who also has a different woman who has damage to her amygdala. And when she has seizures, she starts to think she's a man. So also check out that story on the site.
Okay, well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you covering on Science Now or on the policy site, Science Insider?
Well, Rob, we're looking into a couple stories on Science Now, one about the various factors that influence weight gain. And there's a couple really interesting studies in mice that tell us, for instance, that the time of day we eat can make a difference in how many pounds we pack on. And also a story about why divided brains are smarter. And on the science policy blog, Science Insider, we've got a story about the future of India's planned mission to the moon. Things aren't going very well on that end. And also about the U.S. Coast Guard trying to prevent invasive species from entering American waters. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science news, plus find a link to the science policy blog, Science Insider, at sciencenow.sciencemag.com. And that wraps up the September 4th, 2009 Science Magazine podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine with the support of AAAS, the Science Society. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.